Welcome to Digging the Dharma, where we dig into the Buddhist Dharma and explore ways to bring these 2,500-year-old teachings into our lives. I'm Doug Smith of Doug's Dharma on YouTube and the online Dharma Institute.
And I'm John Aaron, teacher at New York Insight Meditation Center and mindfulness-based stress reduction teacher and teacher trainer and founder of Space to Meditate. Greetings, Doug. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, John. How are you?
Well, I woke up this morning and I actually saw some blue sky.
Oh.
And, you know, it's only been about 10 days.
You're lucky. I haven't seen a blue sky here in a while.
I saw it. It's gone now.
That's gone?
But they say the sun is coming out later.
Supposedly.
And it's a little lighter. The clouds are lightening up a bit. But I have to say, maybe as, you know, aspiring to be awake, I shouldn't be bothered by the weather. But man, not seeing the sun for 8 or 9 days is really tough. It's been a challenge.
That's the whole, you know, one of the reasons the Beatles made the "Here Comes the Sun" and it was so popular, because in London you don't see the sun.
Oh, yes,
in England you don't see.
Yeah, it's challenging. Anyway,
and another challenging issue, which is the topic of today's podcast, the closing of the Rubin Museum, which is not going to happen until October, I think October 8th or something, but still, really sad. I mean, a particular example of anicca, the
truth
of change, impermanence.
Yeah.
But you know, it's sad. It was a museum. For those of you who don't know, it's a New York museum that's only been around for 20 years or so. It's not an old museum.
Yeah, it's very new. It's probably one of the newest museums, actually, in New York.
Yeah, and just a beautiful repository of Himalayan Buddhist art. I mean, mostly from Tibet, Nepal, basically. Mm-hmm. But really well-focused, and they had some nice shows, traveling exhibitions from time to time. It was, and you, I know, have a more close association with them than I do, because you have done or do regular meditations.
Yeah, I'm there, you know, every couple of months. They have a Thursday session on mindfulness that was started, I think, at least 10 years ago by Sharon Salzberg. Mm. So every week they have a different teacher come in and lead. And what's interesting, because, you know, I'm not a Tibetan practitioner. I mean, I have some familiarity, but it's been always fun for me, because part of those meditations is that they're linked to a piece of art.
That's a cool idea.
A month ahead, we'll get a selection of art. You know, there'll be a theme, and then there'll be a selection of art, and we're supposed to choose the one we'd like, first and second choice. I have to admit, I rarely get my first choice, but you'll get like five, because there'll be a theme, and then we'll be sent five images, and we'll choose from those five, and then they have to kind of, you know, work it out, you know, based on what everybody else has requested. But it's been interesting, because I don't, you know, as I say, I don't know enough about Tibetan practices to really relate directly, but relating I mean, it's all related, so it's not that hard. Actually, last week when I did it, the theme was, it was actually energy and effort. And the very first piece of art that you see when you enter the museum is this contemporary sort of neon fierce bodhisattva. And I'm not even sure I forget if it's a specific bodhisattva, but it's this kind of this image of fierceness, and it's great, you know. And so it's not just old Himalayan, it's not just old Tibetan art. It's related, you know. It's they bring in contemporary stuff too.
They do, yeah.
And so these meditations on Thursdays, and they'll keep them going until October. You know, we have to kind of relate to the art in some way. So that's a little fun challenge, you know, for those of us that are doing it. But yeah, and so it's definitely a loss. I can imagine. I think they probably took a pretty big hit during the pandemic. You know, it's a small private museum, basically. So it doesn't have, I mean, it's a different support network, of course, but and their goal is to have a more they call it a museum without walls. We'll see, you know, and have a traveling exhibits and
yeah, it's just not the same.
No, definitely not. But yeah, and so it's impermanence and the nature of, I mean, it's funny because businesses close all the time in New York, but we don't think about institutions closing, even though they do, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the New York Times had a piece saying that it was like one of the first museums to close in New York in a long time. Mm-hmm. That, you know, museums don't usually, I mean, they don't usually open, but when they open, they don't, you know, they don't usually close. I mean, to me, it was, I mean, it's one of my, you know, go-to places. I mean, it's not like I go there that often, but, you know, if I'm thinking of a place to go, I always look at, you know, what they're showing.
Of course.
You know, what they're showing at the Reuben. And in fact, I was just there with my wife a couple of weeks ago when we were in the city. And I sort of ran into a viewer of my YouTube channel, which was really fun. It's the first time that's ever happened, frankly.
I find that hard to believe, Doug.
It's true. It's absolutely true. Somebody who just sort of, you know, recognized me, you know, like, oh.
Right.
So that was sweet. I was, you know, when I was going there, I was thinking maybe somebody's going to recognize me. I hope not, but I'm a private person, but it's a great place. I mean, it's big, you know, it's got several floors, for those of you who haven't been there.
Go now.
I mean, it's got several floors of, I think two or three floors of the permanent exhibition and sort of like highlights, and a lot of really beautiful, beautiful artwork.
Yeah,
really showing a lot of the history of Buddhist art, in particular, of course, in that neighborhood, in that area of the Himalayas. But and then they have, they used to have a really nice little restaurant downstairs that sort of served kind of Indian type food that was really good. But they closed that, I think, in
pandemic
the pandemic, and that was one of those kind of tells where I was like, ooh, I hope this. You know, I hope this doesn't mean they're not.
They still serve coffee, but and tea.
Yeah,
but they don't have the restaurant. Same. Yeah,
and they have a nice little bookstore, gift shop, which has a lot of nice, really interesting Buddhist books and stuff. You know, I mean, obviously, it's materialism in a certain sense, and they're trying to raise money for the museum, which I think is perfectly fine.
Yeah,
but their selection's really pretty, really nice. I mean, they've got it's a beautiful little, and it's off the beaten path. It's near Union Square, off in, I think, 17th Street.
Yeah.
9th Street and 19th Street.
17th and 7th. It's I mean, it's, what's also interesting is that, and I don't know if this is a result of the Reuben, but, you know, the Met in the last 10 years has had two major Buddhist exhibits.
They have.
That have been very successful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so that may have been and of course the Met has a pretty big collection of Asian art on its own, but one does wonder if, you know, they were kind of seeing the interest in places like the Reuben and deciding, well, we should do more of this. And then that even takes people away from the Reuben. I don't know. I mean, it's that whole ecology is a mystery to some degree in terms of, you know, how places survive. And
the Met was the at least the shows that I'm familiar with that the Met did recently on Buddhism, the larger ones, are using material that the Reuben wouldn't have displayed. I mean, early, they were just
I know.
A show on early Buddhism, which was fantastic. I did a video on that. Yeah. But that's material that the isn't really
wouldn't have it. The Reuben, no, for sure. Yeah. And same with the one they had a number of years ago.
Yeah. From Southeast Asia. Yeah. Yeah.
But I think it's just the theme is of Buddhism and art in Buddhism. And it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, we'll see, but I'm sure that some of that collection will be on loan to the Met Museum at some point too.
Could be.
Cause it's a very large collection and I mean, it'll just, and then, you know, they've had some very interesting stuff. I mean, the weekly meditations are one thing, but they have other interesting lectures and readings. And I know, Lama Justin does these sort of experiential dark meditations, which is a later tradition where you basically are in the dark for an extended period, and with they do them at the in the auditorium where you can turn off everything, and it's just to give people a taste of this experience. So that's one example, but they have poetry readings, they have musicians come and go, and they've done a lot. yeah, it's definitely going to be a loss to the city, and we'll see what kind of footprint they leave in the city in terms of how they're planning to continue their work. At least from the correspondence I've had, you know, it sounds like the institute that they have, which is an educational institute, that staff will still be there, but it's much more about outreach worldwide and, you know, probably related to whatever exhibitions they tour around.
Yeah, it's not going to be the same.
No, not at all. It won't. And it's impermanence.
Yeah, I mean, you can't, obviously you can't, yeah. I mean, we all know you can't get too attached to anything.
Yeah. Especially these days.
Especially these days.
But it also, you know, it's kind of fascinating. And we didn't really talk about this too much when we talked about the exhibit at the Met. Was, and I wouldn't necessarily call it spiritual materialism, but when we're viewing works, like, you know, works of art, which have in a sense, a dual purpose, right? I mean, in some of those cases, the works of art were actually meant to inspire either a specific practice or inspire something in the spiritual realm, something in the mind to sort of move us toward awakening. So there's one side of it. The other side is the beauty of the art itself, you know, unrelated to anything else.
Sure.
And
then there's the expense of it all, the value of the pieces.
Well, yeah, of course. So it's... And the Rubin itself is, I guess, from what I understand, and maybe we don't have fact checkers on our show, but I mean, it was a private collection.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And
family collection.
A family collection, and the family said, let's make this public. And of course, in doing so, it raises the value of their art.
Yeah.
You know, which is okay. And it's happened a lot. It happens all the time. There's a couple of museums in New York that are like that.
Right. I mean, I think it's, to me, I've followed the art market a bit over the years. I think it's most insidious when it comes to contemporary art.
Of course.
I think with older art, like this Buddhist art, I mean, it's never going to be that valuable just because of what it is. And I know from talking with people who have worked with this kind of art that, you know, nowadays, at least from their telling, this kind of older artwork, which all this stuff is, you know, from the 16th century, 15th, it's just not popular right now. You know, I mean, of course, it's always going to have a value. It's not going to be cheap. It's going to be, you know, out of the price range of us. But in any event, in the art market, it's considered sort of not hot. Whereas contemporary stuff is really, really valuable. And that's where the real problem becomes. Because how do you, in other words, you might say, okay, you have, you know, person A and person B, and both of them are contemporary artists who are producing bodies of work. Why does person A's art cost 100 times what person Sure. B's does? Yeah. When, you know, sort of quote unquote objectively, you look at them side by side and there's not much difference. And the difference, or, you know, I mean, arguably the difference is that, you know, the artist A has got a patron who either owns a gallery or hopefully owns a gallery and has a very good friend who is the curator of
right.
this kind of art at MoMA
yeah.
and so can get a show of their art at MoMA and then lend the art to MoMA and then gift, you know, they'll gift them five paintings. And then all of the artwork that they have collected, the collector who
skyrockets
has collected,
in value,
skyrockets
yeah.
in value. I mean, this is happens again and again and again. I mean, and that's why you have these Saatchi, whatever it's the Saatchi yeah. galleries or whatever,
yeah.
you know, where they have their own artwork. You know, they yeah. collect their own artwork, then they, you know, then they parcel it out to their,
yeah.
Their favored curators at the contemporary art galleries, because and all of the contemporary art just skyrockets in value because of this, because it's just yeah. this, you know, small, quote unquote, small, you know, amount of money that's chasing the hot
yeah.
young people.
Of course.
This is something that's, to me, is somewhat insidious.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, the same thing. It's not just contemporary. I mean, we look at the value of, like, it's, you know, great master's works, you know, and it's
yeah.
different, but it's,
yeah.
it's still, it's like,
yeah, and then you get fakes and stuff like that, which is the other problem.
Yeah, of course. But in terms of this art, you know, obviously it has value, and there is, we can talk about spiritual materialism, you know, it's just, whereas, you know, somebody, I was talking to somebody the other day about a particular person who's well known in the quote spiritual world, who has, you know, as a spiritual teacher, he, and I'm staying away from naming anybody, you know, but he has value, but he also is, you know, he's on major networks and things like that. And so he gets a lot of attention, and then he has products, you know, that he sells. And it's like, where does that end? And it's like, good for his success. You know, I mean, it's great, but how many people are buying that because of him versus because of any sort of spiritual desire for waking up, or you know, or doesn't that Buddha look nice in my garden?
But what kind of product is he selling?
Furniture, he's selling, you know, okay. Iconography, various things, you know, and it's like, and he's not selling them. I mean, it's obviously somebody, it's like marketing his name, right? So it's like, you know, let's not get into marketing of names, because we know where that has led, but, you know, it's just fascinating to me how things take on a different meaning.
Yeah, there are all kinds of fine lines here. Yeah, I mean, when it comes to, I mean, I think we've discussed this before about the fact that any layperson who's going to be a Dharma teacher has got to figure out a way to make a living somehow.
For sure. Yeah.
And you've got to sell something in order to make a living. You know, I mean, those of us, look, I mean, Patreon is wonderful for people who are donating. But I give things to people on Patreon, which is free videos and so on. Mm-hmm. They're not free. That's the point. They're videos that are viewable by people on Patreon who've donated money. We have donors here who support our podcast, but very few. And frankly, I mean, you know, do they even cover our costs of making
barely,
the shows?
Yeah, barely. Barely. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's an issue.
Yeah.
It's sure.
That's different. I mean, I think that, you know, we're talking about, you know, the nature of selling an object, which is really a spiritual object, but then becomes basically a piece of decoration.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, it's because how many Buddhas have we seen in gardens, you know?
Absolutely. And, I mean, and there's, you know, again, there's this kind of, I mean, to me, I'm of two minds, and I think you probably are too. On the one hand, it is kind of a spiritual materialism, having a piece of a Buddha or whatever that is, you know, I mean, like when you go to the shop window and somebody has a Buddha there in amongst, you know, the clothing or whatever, which is supposed to give you a kind of an air of, I don't know, Eastern mysticism or something. I don't know what it's there for, but in any event, but there's another aspect of it where at least hopefully seeing an image like that is going to give somebody a little bit of inspiration and make them smile a bit and feel happier. And
maybe
it has a positive impact.
Depends on who yeah, of course. I mean, you know, who am I to talk? I mean, our house is filled with such things, but it's there. I'm looking at one now, you know, and it's just a reminder.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, you know, you can look, go to a place, you can go now until October to a place like the Rubin, and you can certainly, you know, frame it as a bunch of very expensive, pretty things. And that's a perfectly, I think, appropriate way to frame it. But you can also frame it as someplace that people can take a lot of inspiration from. And certainly when I go there, I leave it in a you know, feeling inspired by a lot of the, even though it's not really, as you say, it's not really also not really my tradition, that kind of Tibetan tradition is not really mine. But even so, just being there with these beautiful and inspirational kinds of images, and they all have meaning, and they were intended to be instructive and didactic and, you know, inspirational. That was the intention of making them. So, you know, there's a lot of
For sure. I mean, what's interesting is that, I mean, this is just the nature of museums in general, right? Is that, especially when we're talking about the artworks at the Rubin, they were not created for the purpose of being in a museum.
Oh, for sure.
Or for the purpose of being in somebody's private gallery. And so here we are, you know, but now, you know, because of the nature of society and the nature of Western culture, that isn't, you know, attuned to these practices as much, although more and more, of course. You know, one does wonder, like, if a museum like the Rubin would have been created had it not been for the growing popularity, the growing interest in Buddhist practice and particularly Tibetan practice because of the Dalai Lama and other personalities.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously that has had a huge impact. And not just, you know, Tibetan practices, but I mean, just Buddhist practice in general. You know, that has helped, no doubt, make the Rubin a success in itself. So it's a two-way street in a sense. You know, here are these pieces of art that were created for very specific purposes generally. I mean, some of the contemporary stuff is another matter, but the older works obviously were all created for a reason and a reason related to practice.
Yeah.
And now they are seen on a wall or in a case and, or it's, I mean, Rubin has some fantastic experiential exhibits too. And, you know, so in that process, and this is what you were saying, it inspires, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, they also have that, as you know, they have the Shrine Room there, which tries to recreate, you know, at least in a tiny piece of what these images might have looked like in their original context. On the other hand, I mean, there's always, you know, in any kind of museum, there's always going to be this question of, you know, the difference in context. You know, every piece you see in, not every piece, but virtually every piece you see in a museum, especially older pieces, are out of their original context.
Sure. Yeah, just.
And I mean, I think to me, of course, there's a downside, there's a drawback, but of course, the great upside is that it brings this material to people who would never have been face to face with it before.
Yeah.
So, you know, over the past 20 years, people have been able to go to the Rubin and see images that they never would have seen. And it might be the sort of thing that inspires them.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of good in that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what's really I was thinking about a museum like the Cloisters.
Of course.
Right.
Yeah. Another one. Good example.
You know, which is, you know, all about sacred art.
And it's a pastiche itself, the Cloisters.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's you know, and wouldn't it be cool if there was somebody actually built a space based on models of Tibetan temples that then became a museum like the, you know, that would be like a whole other.
That would be thing. Great. There is actually a Tibetan museum, shrine museum in Staten Island, which I visited many, many years ago. That has an actual shrine room, like it's an actual.
Is it a monastery? I mean, is itself a monastery, or is
I don't remember. I'd have to look it up, and I'm sure some of our viewers, or listeners, I should say, will be familiar with it. Anybody who has been around Staten Island in New York, I've forgotten the name of it, but it's a.
Okay.
I think it's an active Tibetan shrine. Although I honestly don't remember. I don't think it's supposed to be like a museum. I think it's an actual shrine. Actually, but it's a place you can visit as you would visit a museum.
Yeah.
But it's small. It's relatively small.
Yeah.
And of course, there are Tibetan monasteries all over the place.
Yeah, of course.
So
it's a little different. But it is. I mean,
but it's where you would have seen these pieces.
Yeah, 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 yeah. You know, and it's like, God, you go to any museum, of course, and you see major sacred works. Are works from sacred spaces that are now put in, you know, on display. I mean, and that's what part of what museums do is, I mean, it's preserving something. And so, yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate that the Rubin is closing. It'll be interesting to see sort of how it manifests in its new guise, if that's even workable, and they're confident that it is, we'll see. And for the time being though, it's open until October 6th. I think that's the date it was closing, or the 10th.
Something like that, 8th or something, yeah.
Yeah, somewhere in there. And it was an old Barney's clothing store. It'll be interesting to see what the building becomes next, you know.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful building. So hopefully something important and interesting will take its place. But it's a Nietzsche in action.
And Dukkha for those of us who enjoy the place.
Yeah. Good to see you, Doug. Folks, until next time, we appreciate your coffee.
Leave us some comments, some questions at the website,
diggingthedharma.com. Yep, and keep digging it. All right. Take care, Doug.
Thanks a lot, John.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave a review on your podcast directory. And please check us out at digginthedharma.com, where you can leave a comment, buy us a coffee, and even become a member. You can find out more about me, John Aaron, at johnaaron.net, and Doug at dougsdharma.com.